Welcome, everybody. Today, our guest is Monica Martinez. She's the former executive director of Partnership for Extraordinary Minds, a nonprofit in Montgomery County, and now she's working as a special education advocate with Susan Blattner and Associates, again in Montgomery County, but really serving all of Maryland, I believe, remotely. Today, we're going to touch on who Monica is. She's going to share a little bit of her background, why she's tied to the disability community, what brought her in. What exactly a special education advocate is. I know for myself, I have confusions. I was confused about the difference between an advocate and a consultant. Monica was gracious enough to make sure I understood the difference, and we're going to make sure I'm not the only one out there that gets that mixed up. We're going to touch on when to hire one. I want to highlight here that, in my personal opinion, I don't think an advocate should always be picked when you want to stick it to the school, as it were. And I really want to, and I think Monica is going to do a great job explaining how a collaborative process tends to be a much more effective process because people are all working towards the same goal. Most everybody, I can't say everybody, but most everybody, they want what's best for your child. And I think if we go into those meetings with that mindset, we can avoid some of the friction. And then, how do you find one? What questions should you ask? These are all things I know when I was hiring my advocate, I got lucky. I had a friend of mine who connected me with somebody. And the purpose of when I hired the advocate was really because I wanted somebody to speak in a calmer tone. I tend to get very passionate, and I didn't want to be very confrontational in the IEP meeting when my son transitioned from middle school to high school. And I was afraid that my passion would muddy the waters. So I hired somebody to be my voice. That's just one example. So let's get started by Monica. Welcome and share a little bit about you and your background.
Thanks, Eric. Thank you for having me here today. I appreciate this opportunity. I came to advocacy through my own personal family journey. I didn't start out doing this. I was actually a Russian literature major and then went into library science and was working in the information security intelligence analysis field. And then I had twins. And then it became apparent that one of the twins was much further behind his brother. And in fact, turned out to have autism. My intelligence analysis ways took a back seat so that I could be home and have some more time to help him engage in his therapies and get more involved in how we're going to be able to help him live to his fullest potential. During that time, I found Partnership for Extraordinary Minds, which, as Eric mentioned, is a Montgomery County, Maryland-based nonprofit whose sole mission is to advocate for the improved educational experiences and outcomes of students on the autism spectrum in grades K through 12. Although we do some work with the preschool families because they're trying to get them prepared for entry into elementary school. And then we do also are trying to expand our ability to address some of the transition issues because 12th grade is not really 12th grade. 12th grade can go on for many years. So we're trying to, bridge that gap as well. So I got involved as writing the newsletter, and then I was the vice president, and then the president, and then the executive director. And then while I was involved in that, I clearly became more involved in advocacy, which was part of our mission, and found the Council of Parent Advocates and Attorneys, COPPA. And you can find their website at COPPA, COPAA.org. They are a national organization based in Towson, Maryland, conveniently, and they offer special education advocacy training courses for parents and professionals alike. And so I enrolled in their, it's called SEAT, stands for Special Education Advocacy Training, SEAT. I did their 2.0 session, which is like a full year online course that teaches parents and other advocates who are already practicing in the field, the backgrounds of the federal law and how that applies to special education. So that was a great training program. And at the end of the online course, all students are required to do 40 hours of supervised internship, which I was lucky to do with Suzanne Blattner, who is one of the better known advocates in Montgomery County, Maryland. So fortunately, that went very well, and Susie offered me a job. So I happily took that position and stepped down from my role in XMinds, which I've been involved for maybe 9 years. So it was time to go. So, but I still work. I'm on the advisory board for XMinds, still very closely in touch with their current leadership. but now I'm working as a special education advocate in Susie Blattner's practice.
And that's a good segue into talking about what exactly a special education advocate does.
Yeah, exactly. So as Eric mentioned, first we discussed, you know, I think when we were going over this presentation, we initially had put in educational consultant. And I said, well, educational consultant's a more general term, which can also apply to families whose students do not have any special education needs, typically developing kids who are looking for maybe a private school placement or something that's more in line with their special interests, like the performing arts or STEM. So educational consultants often work with families and do testing to get students into private schools. So I guess a subset of that would be a special education advocate who, and our work is primarily focused on getting students the special education supports they need in public schools. And if the public school is unable to meet those needs, then we help families determine and identify a good private school option and also help work through the process of getting public funding for a private school placement if that's appropriate. So when we start out, at the beginning of many parents' journeys, they find that their student's not doing well in school. Something's gone awry, or they're not making the progress they would expect them to be making, or perhaps discipline issues are coming up. The student's having behaviors that parents did not anticipate having. So parents might approach a special education advocate to help with starting the eligibility process. So under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, which all special education advocates should have a firm understanding of. The eligibility process involves parents or a teacher or someone in the school requesting that the student be screened for possible identification of a disability and whether the disability is of a nature, a severe enough nature that it warrants special education services in school. So that's a process many parents seek our guidance on, because as advocates, we are aware of the federally and state mandated timelines for these things to take place, which may be very difficult for a parent to find out and be aware of and hold the school district accountable to those deadlines. Similarly, we have several clients that are seeking Section 504 accommodations. Section 504 refers to that part of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 that provides equal access to students with disabilities in school. So that's actually more of a civil rights law as opposed to a disability education law, but still we do help clients to get access to a 504 plan. So those are some of the things that we start out with.
You mentioned that you have Section 504, which is a civil rights law, and then IEP, which is the special education law. When do you get an attorney involved? I mean, I do hear people talking about going out to get an attorney versus an advocate, but I feel like an advocate seems the better way to go initially, maybe?
Yeah, certainly getting an advocate is less confrontational. So I think you referred to in your intro about taking a collaborative approach. And that is certainly our position as a practice. We're very much focused on collaborating with the school team because we want to presume, like you said, that the school team and the parents all have the student's best interest at heart. Generally speaking, teachers want to be able to support the kids in their classroom, but sometimes they don't know how, especially if a student is in a general education setting. Some of the teachers don't have a special education training. I think in Maryland, in order to become a teacher, you have to take like one credit bearing course in special education to get your master's in education. So unless there's a dual certification process going on, a lot of general educators don't have a lot of hands-on experience or background knowledge of special ed. And I'm not saying that to belittle them at all. Their job is hard enough as it is. So that's why they didn't specialize in that. So that's why we work with families to help identify what other professionals in the community might be able to help bring their case forward and then work collaboratively with the school team. So let me just backtrack a bit. I talked at the opening about parents seeking us when their kids do not have an IEP or a 504 plan. We also get a lot of clients whose students already have IEPs or 504 plans, and they're finding that they're not robust enough, or they're not tailored to the student in the way that they had hoped they would, or they want someone to take a second look and say, hey, are these goals appropriate for my student? Is my kid really making the progress that he or she should be making? And so when we have a new client come in, we ask them to provide us with ideally 2 years of IEPs if they have those, so we can look at progress over time. And then any testing that was done, either by the school. So the school will do, if the student has an IEP, they are required every 3 years to retest this, reevaluate the student in areas of suspected disability. So that could be a psychological assessment, educational achievement, speech and language, occupational therapy, physical therapy. Some students who have behavior plans also have the data that drives those behavior plans gets looked at and recollected. So all of those documents are things that we as a team would want to read, especially if you have any, if parents have outside evaluations from third-party providers, like a neuropsychological evaluation that provides a lot of really insightful information. That gives us a snapshot into what the student's potential is, or what their overall cognitive ability is, and how is that matching up against the achievement at school. If there's a big discrepancy, then that suggests that the supports in place are not robust enough, and that's where we start digging. So our role as advocates is to review all of these documents and come up with our own independent opinion of where the case is and what supports, or you know, what the next steps would be for the family, and to provide that independent and unbiased information to them. We also want to make sure that parents understand all the information, so we take the time to explain anything that isn't clear to them, especially the special education process. That is a lot of arcane knowledge goes into determining how to navigate special education in any particular school district. And that's where we have a lot of experience and can really help explain that to parents, like who's who in the IEP meeting and who do we need to talk to move forward. And then we typically go with the parents to the IEP meeting or the Section 504 meeting. And now we're doing that virtually. You know, we're still attending meetings. Meetings are still happening even in the pandemic environment. And so and we also collaborate with any professionals. Like I mentioned before, if a parent has done a private neuropsych, or if their kid is in therapy, we will, you know, after gaining authorization from the parents, we will contact those professionals to, you know, get a better understanding of what they were seeing when they were working with the student or when they evaluated the student. So we really try to take a holistic approach. And yes, we do focus on being collaborative, because as the saying goes, you get further with sugar than vinegar, or whatever the saying is, but something like that.
Well, I mean, so. I'm thinking, you know, you're working, the family is only going to see this IEP team, you know, while the student's in that year. As an advocate, you're going to be seeing this IEP team over and over and over again. And if you burn a bridge, you know, maybe you get it for this client, but the other clients, probably not. I mean,
yep, absolutely. And that's why it's important to maintain a cordial at a minimum, but, you know, a positive working relationship, because you're going to have a lot of other families going through the same school teams, and you want to maintain a good working relationship for future clients as well.
And professionals disagree, right? That's okay. Professionals can disagree.
Of course.
And it doesn't get personal.
That's right. Right. That's the goal, is to say, hey, well, our interpretation of the data is XYZ. Sorry that you don't see it that way, and you know, what can we do to come to a compromise or a solution that's going to work for both of us. Another piece which I just wanted to mention before we move on, typically I or Susie or you know our the consultants in our practice, the special ed advocates, will be, prior to COVID, we would observe the student in the classroom or in the educational setting where they're spending most of their time, and that really provides invaluable information into what do things look like on the ground? How is the student functioning in their current setting? That is the biggest piece that's missing now, given the school closures. We can't really get that same snapshot and understanding of how the student's doing on a daily basis. So I think moving forward, we're going to see about the possibility of observing over Zoom or meeting, you know, finding other ways to get some of this information, which will not be as good as the way it was before. So hopefully this will only be temporary, but.
You know, I'm hoping you're able to do that, but watching a child in a learning environment in their home is going to be much different than a classroom. Yeah, you know, even no matter how structured a parent may be, it's still not the same.
Absolutely. But I know, especially, you know, I have a specialization in autism, and I know that you can see some things even anywhere that would be indicative of a student that's on the autism spectrum. And sometimes parents are not convinced that their child has autism, and if you're seeing a lot of stereotypies, you know, you can see that over a Zoom, and that definitely helps you form an opinion. Okay, yeah, this kid's probably on the spectrum. I mean, I'm sure stereotypies occur in other with other conditions, but there are some things that are highly indicative of autism spectrum disorder. So
what I've heard so far, Monica, that I wanted to tie a bow on, because it ties into these considerations, is when, regardless of where you live, when you're thinking of hiring an advocate, you really want to make sure you understand what's their level of education, not just how much college they have, but you mentioned COPA offers a one-year training, and I'm going to make sure I include that link when I go to the show notes. You know, because somebody could have, maybe they don't have a master's in education, but they, you know, but they can go through this training, which is really geared towards helping you understand the IEP process. And that seems like a pretty strong foundation, especially working with an organization like Susie Blattner, right, and associates. I mean, because then when you're in that bigger organization, if you don't know something, you have this team to fall back on. So you,
right.
What I heard you say was, let's look at what type of background your advocate has, what type of supports or team are they a part of. It's not good or bad if they're not a part of a bigger organization, but it's something to consider, right? Ask about their approach, or maybe talk to other people that have worked with that advocate to see how the approach was. Because it feels to me like some of this has to be personality. Like, if I'm going to hire you, I'm going to be spending a lot of time with you. No offense, but I have to like you.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point that I wanted to make, that there are, you know, Susie and I, the Susie Blattner Associates, on the whole, takes a very collaborative approach. And our goal is to be accommodating. What's the phrase? Firm but gentle, firm but kind. And there are other people, you know, other advocates who are more aggressive. And so there's a whole spectrum of personality types and approaches to negotiating, which this is a negotiation when you're meeting with the IEP team. So lots of people have different negotiation styles. So you're absolutely right that you need to be comfortable with this negotiation style of the advocate you're hiring. And a lot of that can be found out through word of mouth. In Montgomery County, there is this MC Needs, Montgomery County Needs listserv, which has been, I know there's a lot of traffic on this listserv, and you can find people who will give you feedback on a variety of advocates there. Some other places, like you mentioned, COPA, the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, it's a tricky name, but COPA does maintain a database that is publicly accessible of advocates and attorneys throughout the country. Not all advocates that are practicing in this area that I know personally are members of COPA, but many of us are. There's also the Parents Place of Maryland, which IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act, mandates that each state there is funding, I'm sorry, through IDEA for one parent training and information center in each state. And Maryland's Parent Training and Information Center is Parents Place of Maryland. And you can find them online at ppmd.org. They may be able to give parents referrals to advocates in whatever part of the state they're in. Also, Disability Rights Maryland, which is, I'm not sure where they're located, but they're another organization in Maryland that handles special education rights cases. They do have some pro bono attorneys there. So if your case kind of escalates to the level where you need to bring an attorney in, that might be a good place to start. They don't take on, you know, every client pro bono, but they can at least give you some feedback about your case and point you in the right direction. So those are some other sources for referrals. Also, WISER, WISER is another organization that lots of professionals in the special ed community join. So you could also find some information that way.
If you're not living in Maryland or DC, word of mouth is probably going to work. You know, believe it or not, I think teachers are happy to give referrals to advocates that they've worked well with, assuming that you don't have the issue with the teacher themselves.
Well, assuming that, right? That is sometimes that's not the case. But COPA again is as a national organization, so they would be able to hook you up with advocates in other states. They have that information is available there.
The other consideration you have, because you mentioned Montgomery County, and well, Maryland has many different counties, and every school district in the counties can be a little different. So I'd imagine one of the considerations would be the experience an advocate has in that county, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I personally have not done any work in Virginia. I wouldn't be a very good fit for someone who's looking to work in Virginia at this point. Maybe that will change in the future. Susie has a lot of experience working in Prince George's County and some in Howard County, Frederick County. But again, that is another consideration for parents to think about when they're hiring someone. What jurisdictions, which school districts does the advocate have experience in? Another consideration that often no one wants to talk about is cost. It's not a free service, unfortunately. I think that it would be great if we could provide more pro bono services, and maybe that's something to work on in the future. But different advocates charge different, have different fee structures. So you want to make sure you have that conversation up front. What is the hourly rate? Do they charge by the hour? Is there a retainer that would cover X number of hours of service? Is there a retainer or a package deal that would cover record review, parent intake, you know, first draft of the IEP, attending the IEP meeting? So you need to find out how things are billed and how much. It's hard to get a good sense of how much your monthly bill could be. So make sure you ask that up front. How many hours do you think this case will take? And, you know, how do you bill that?
And I'm glad you brought that up, Monica, because just listening to what you shared, you mentioned you go to an IEP. So you're looking at an hour to an hour and a half there. You mentioned you observe in the classroom, that could be half an hour to an hour. You review psychological records, that could be an hour or more. You review other records. I mean, right there, you're looking at 4 to 6 hours.
Yeah, and if the case is complicated, it could take longer, especially if you're rewriting big portions of the IEP. You should have a frank conversation with the advocate about what it is that you want them to do. Maybe you just want them to review it and provide their insights, and that's it. Maybe you want them to rewrite goals for you. And we're very, as a practice, we're very flexible. If there are things we think parents can do on their own and they're willing to do that, then, you know, we can be there to like review it or edit their documents. I'm thinking primarily of like the parent reports that parents are invited to submit before any annual review. Because we want to keep costs down for parents. We know it's a huge expense, probably on top of a lot of other expenses like therapy or ABA, medical expenses if their student has a physical disability or complex medical needs. So, you know, we're mindful of the expense, you know, that parents can run into. But that's definitely something you want to be upfront about, because nobody likes to be surprised.
Right. And I'm always a big believer that you don't always want to go with the cheapest option. Sometimes they're a good fit, but sometimes you're really hurting yourself, penny wise, pound foolish, you know?
Right.
And I think we covered how to choose an advocate, but is there anything else that you'd want to highlight here?
Well, yeah, I did want to talk a little bit about an attorney, because I think, you know, that was one of the questions you had brought up. When do you hire an attorney? What's the difference between an advocate and attorney? So as I mentioned before, you know, going straight to the attorney is a pretty aggressive move. If you bring an attorney to an IEP meeting, the school district will also bring their attorney. You need to inform them. So right out the gate, it gets pretty adversarial, because you're going to automatically be having two attorneys sitting at the table. Sometimes that's warranted. Sometimes you need an attorney. So some of those examples would be, if you cannot come to an agreement with your IEP team, let's say you've hired an advocate, you've really, you know, the advocate has done the best that he or she can do to try to get your case through, to get the supports that you want. A lot of times this comes up when you're trying to get a student placed at a private school. That can be a very difficult endeavor. You have to have a lot of data to back up your case that the school district is not able to support your student's needs. So if the school district refuses to take the case to Central, that's the Central IEP meeting where decisions are made about public placement options in a private school. Does that make sense? We're publicly funded private school enrollment. Then if you cannot come to an agreement, then often these cases will go to due process. So due process is an official hearing with a hearing officer. And in Maryland, the burden of proving your case is on the person who brings the action. So if a parent is filing a due process action against the school district because they are contending that the school has not provided a free and appropriate public education, then the burden is on the parent to prove their case. This is not the case in like New York or New Jersey, where the burden of proof is on the state. But in Maryland, despite lobbying efforts of many organizations for over many years, the burden of proof is still on the parents if they are bringing the case. Conversely, if the school is filing a due process case against the parent, which doesn't happen very often, but could, especially now in terms of parental consent laws having changed regarding taking a student off the diploma track, but we don't want to really go down a rabbit hole, so we can talk about that's a whole other topic. But anyway, but you would need an attorney in that case too, if the school district brought due process against you. Advocates cannot participate in due process hearings. In Maryland, you must have an attorney or represent yourself, which I do not recommend, because the school district has a very strong and robust and deep legal team. So really getting a good attorney would be necessary if you have any hopes of winning a due process case.
And so to be clear, it's not easy winning a due process case, right? I mean, not very many.
No. The odds, like I said, the odds are stacked against the parents because the school district, and this is my opinion, so, you know, it's not fact, but in terms of having access to data, the school district, they're the owners of the data. So they have more access to more robust data than parents do, or that an attorney can get. Although an attorney can probably get more data from the school district than a parent could on their own. Another area when you might want to have an attorney is if you have already unilaterally placed your child at a private special education school and you are hoping to get tuition reimbursement.
Meaning you pulled your kid out of school for whatever reason and you said, I want you to go to this private school, and now I'm paying $50,000 to $75,000 a year in tuition.
Yes. And if you're going to seek reimbursement from the public school system, the local education authority, as it's referred to in the law, the LEA, then you'll want an attorney to help you file for tuition reimbursement. An advocate cannot do that. And I mean, we don't do that. I don't know if other advocates do, but that's an area where you would want someone with legal expertise. Another area, which I am sure is going to be a topic of discussion, it already is, but even more so once schools reopen, is the matter of compensatory education. If you feel that your student has not been receiving the services that were outlined in the IEP and that the school district owes your student compensatory education, that owes them makeup basically for what they weren't providing, you will need an attorney to help you file for compensatory education. It's similar to tuition reimbursement, but it's not the same thing, because in some cases, compensatory education is fulfilled by the school district. Like the school district will provide additional hours, additional service hours. But again, a good attorney might be able to get you funding for private therapy instead, or private services. So that's where you would want an attorney.
And you should expect that attorneys are going to be more expensive than your average advocate. And I mean, I'm not comfortable giving prices out because I don't know. But I know in my experience, it's not unusual to see attorneys charging anywhere upwards of $250, $300 an hour.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Also, attorneys will go with you to your IEP meeting if you want them to. We do work with attorneys. So I've had several cases where the parents have hired us or have hired me as their advocate for their student, and but they're also working with an attorney. And that's, you know, and those are cases where, again, we're trying to get a student a private placement, and where it's possible that the student's procedural or substantive rights to a free and appropriate education have been violated. If those rights have been violated, that's where an attorney can really be beneficial. What an advocate can do is help parents in writing a state complaint. So Maryland State Department of Education has this complaint process, I think all states do, where you can seek specific remedies from the State Department of Education. And so, you know, an advocate can help a parent prepare that letter, prepare a state complaint, but that would probably be the most extensive thing we would do if you're going to be seeking, you know, damages, for lack of a better word, if you're going to be asking for compensation in some form or another. Like we discussed before, that's when you would need an attorney. And again, in due process hearings, an advocate cannot represent you. You would need an attorney.
So in my mind, Monica, it sounds like there may eventually come a point where a parent may have to make the decision, am I going to continue fighting with no guarantee I'm going to win and just bleeding my bank account dry, or am I going to pull my kid out of school because I think private placement is really the best solution, pay out of pocket and accept I'm paying out of pocket. And, you know, there are some things that you can do for the taxes there. Or are you going to say, well, you know, I will make do with what I have with the school I'm in? So there's three real options that at some point parents are just going to have to decide on.
Yeah, and that's a personal decision based on circumstances that, you know, are unique to each case. But yeah, that does happen, you know, parents can be between a rock and a hard place. So
I want to circle back. I mean, we touched a lot about everything that an advocate can do when the school IEP program may not be meeting the student's needs. But I want to touch on one last thing here for last thoughts is, and maybe I'm wrong, but it's my opinion and my belief that sometimes parents are just being a little unreasonable with their expectations for what the school should be delivering. Am I off base there?
Sometimes that is the case. And that's a good point and something I think, you know, I tried to underscore before, but that I would like to have this opportunity to say again, that our role as an advocate is to give parents, you know, the unvarnished truth. You want this. You know, this is your goal for your child, but after our independent review of this data, we think, yeah, that's great. We should try to get, you know, we should work towards that goal. Or conversely, that is not a realistic goal. This data is saying XYZ, and that, you know, usually typically translates to these outcomes. And so there is sometimes where we have to, you know, have a frank conversation with the parent that the data is not pointing in that direction. In our professional opinions, based on X numbers of years seeing similar cases, you know, the most likely trajectory or the most likely outcome is whatever. And these are the steps that we can, you know, use to maximize that and to get the maximum benefit for your child, given the state of play, given where he or she is cognitively or behaviorally or whatever the issue at hand is. So, you know, that is tough sometimes when parents don't want to hear what you have to say. But we are not, you know, for lack of a better term, we're not hired guns. Our position in our practice is that we are going to give you honest, independent, and frank feedback. We don't want to be in a position of being hired to do what a parent wants when we think that's ethically not the right way to go.
You're not order takers. You're not just saying, okay, I'll, you know. Right.
And so that's another consideration that parents can think about when they're entering into a relationship with an advocate. I don't know, maybe there are advocates that would do that, but it's a matter of ethics, and the parents should understand that our role is to be independent and give you honest feedback, not to be a hired gun.
Thank you, Monica. I mean, what I've heard throughout this webinar is the common theme of you will do your best to help the parent get what they want as long as it's what the child needs.
Yeah.
And you're going to do so in a way that respects both the parent and the staff of whatever school district you're working with.
Yes, that is the goal. And that's, you know, that's another consideration is what are the parents' goals and what are the child's goals? I mean, sometimes you can't suss that out, but that is something to think about. When parents are talking to an advocate, when they're considering hiring one, they should also understand that an advocate cannot promise any particular outcome, right? There are so many factors that go into any given case that, you know, we cannot guarantee X, Y, or Z. We cannot guarantee you a private placement at X, Y, Z school. So that's another piece of the conversation that needs to be had up front before entering into any kind of arrangement with an advocate. Like you said, the advocate's going to do their best job to achieve the parent's goals that they've agreed, that the advocate and the parent have agreed to pursue together in a collaborative way, so that the relationship between the parent and the student and the school district remains intact to the greatest extent possible.
And I really love that you finished on that note, Monica, because it could be the way I interpret things on Facebook or I hear conversations, but I think we're getting very confrontational, very litigious. And I don't think that helps anybody. I really think the way you and Susie Blatter and Associates approach things, maybe it might appear to take longer or you're being too nice, but when you're talking about human beings interacting with each other, you've got to treat each other with respect. I mean, that's, again, this is my opinion, but I really love the way you guys take the approach.
Yeah. Well, and I don't want to diss attorneys, because although attorneys are litigious by nature, a lot of the attorneys we work with are also very collaborative and work towards maintaining relationships. So
yeah, that wasn't meant for attorneys.
No, I know. But I just want to make sure that's clear, because there is a time and a place for an attorney. And even if you have to hire an attorney, it doesn't have to be necessarily overly confrontational.
The attorneys I've come across, they're more than willing to say, you know, I think you'd be better served by an advocate at this point. So yeah. I agree with you. I don't want people walking away saying, oh, Eric thinks badly of the attorneys.
No. Just making that clear, just clarifying. So
when people want to find you, the website is up here and then your email is up here. I'll make sure I have both of these in the show notes. I really appreciate you making the time to talk to me today, Monica, and sharing. I learned a lot. Education is not my world, so I really appreciate it. And I want to end on, I don't want families waiting until things get to a crisis to reach out to an advocate. I really want to encourage families, if they have questions, even if it's, I'm not really sure what this IEP is saying, call, reach out to an advocate. I mean, it can't hurt.
Yeah, and that's another thing. We do give a free half hour, you know, kind of review consultation up front, so that parents, you know, can get a sense of what would the services be like if they were to hire us. But yeah, and there are also places that, you know, can help explain the IEP to parents that are not advocates. But yeah, I think one of the things that I've seen a lot this year is parents who have waited until the situation is so bad that that if they had contacted an advocate, any advocate, before, a lot of the difficulties their kids are facing in school could have been avoided, or hopefully could have been mitigated to some extent. So yeah, earlier is better than waiting to see.
Like so many things.
I know. Sounds like an autism diagnosis, right? Earlier ID is better than waiting and hoping. So.
Yep. No, thank you very much, Monica. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the ABCs of Disability Planning podcast. We invite your feedback and comments. Please feel free to leave a review wherever you are listening. And don't forget to hit like, follow, and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. If you would like to connect, please email me, eric@specialneedsnavigator.us. If you'd like to learn more about or talk with a guest, please reference the show notes to find the best way to reach them.